Good morning. Max Feinberg was very concerned with Jewish continuity. So much so that when he was drafting his will, when he was setting up a trust, he included what became known as the Jewish clause. One of the provisions of the trust was that any grandchild that would marry out, that would marry a non-Jewish spouse, would be considered deceased and would be completely cut out of the will. Now, unfortunately, as time went on, the sad truth was that 4 out of 5 of Max's grandchildren, in fact, intermarried. As you can imagine, after Mr. and Mrs. Feinberg passed away, they left over a sizable estate. There was very significant litigation over this trust. And at one point, the grandchildren sued the children, they sued their parents for embezzling money from the trust. The children made a motion to have the case dismissed. They said the grandchildren had no standing, they had married, they had assimilated, and they were not entitled to any of the estate. The judge that heard the case threw out the Jewish clause. He said it's not enforceable, and each of the grandchildren is entitled to a share of the estate. And he explained that this clause was against public policy. It seems there's a public policy that you can't have a provision of a will or a trust that discourages marriages or encourages divorce. And the judge said, if you're going to limit the choice of the grandchildren, they can't marry whoever they want, it has to be someone Jewish, against public policy, the clause is void. Now, as you can imagine, as soon as this ruling was handed down, there was a tremendous uproar among many of the Jewish organizations. Essentially, a judge was ruling that fighting assimilation is against public policy. So there was a major tumult, and immediately a number of the national Jewish organizations began working on an appeal. Ultimately, I believe Aguda, the OU, and Torah Mesorah joined forces, and they filed a brief in support of the appeal. Now, while they were working on this brief, one of the attorneys from Lawyer apparently was learning Daf Yomi, and he came across a Gemara, and he reached a shocking conclusion. Based on his interpretation of this Gemara, the judge was right. Not only was this Jewish clause against public policy, this clause seemed to violate halacha. Suddenly, everything's put on hold. These Jewish organizations aren't going to file an appeal, a brief on behalf of an appeal, if this whole clause violated halacha. So they didn't know what to do. Is this clause mutar al pi halacha? Is it not? Now, to understand what the issue is and to understand what ultimately happened, we need a little bit of a background of some of the basic Hilchos Yerusha. We all know that there's a Seder HaYerusha. When a person passes away, the Torah defines who the Yerushim are, who inherits the estate, and how the estate is distributed. Now, before we go into what the Seder HaYerusha is, I'd like to briefly say what it's not. What it's not is politically correct. The Torah sets up the Seder HaYerusha, and it's interesting, for hundreds of years, people have had complaints. Already in there's a Tshuvas HaRosh that discusses a case, the Shoyel. It seems that what was considered enlightened and civilized in those days was to leave the entire estate to the oldest child. That was fashionable, that's what this quote-unquote civilized people used to do, the nobles, the kings. And the Shoyel wanted to do that also. He wanted to make sure that his Bukhar got the entire estate. The Rosh was clearly unimpressed. He says it's very nice that this is how the Goyim do it. It's very nice that this is what's considered civilized. We have Halacha, we have the Torah, and the Rosh was very uninterested in trying to work out in Eitzah. So as we're going to see, as we go through the Seder HaYerusha, It's, you know, there are parts of it that people sometimes have difficulty understanding. At the end of the day, it's Yerusha is a chukas mishpat. It's a choik. Whether we do understand it, we don't understand it, is not especially relevant. But let's go through some of the basic halachos, the basic seder ha-Yerusha. If a married woman dies, the entire estate goes to the husband. A husband is a Yerush. The children, the grandchildren get nothing. The husband yarshins the entire estate. The reverse is not true. When a husband dies, a woman is not a Yerush. She's entitled to her ksuba. We'll get back to this a little bit more a bit later. But in, as a matter of Yerusha, inheritance, his estate passes to his children, not to his wife. Now, which children get the Yerusha? So the halacha is that if a person has sons, the sons receive the entire estate. Person has, for example, daughters do not receive any share in the Yerusha if there are sons. Again, this is Midoraisa. Person has five daughters and one son, the entire estate goes to the son. Grandchildren do not receive any Yerusha if their parents, if the children are alive. The only time a grandchild gets any share of an estate, any share of Yerusha, is if the son, if the grandchild's parents had predeceased the grandfather, then his children, his Yerushim, are in his place. They receive the share that he would have gotten. But assuming the sons are all alive, grandchildren are not entitled to any share of the Yerusha. Now, if there are no sons, the Yerusha goes to the daughters. When there are sons, so there's a concept of a bechor. Assuming the oldest child is a male, and he was born naturally, as opposed to a C-section, a bechor that was born through a C-section does not have the din of pishnayim. But assuming the oldest child is a male, and he was born naturally, he has the din of a bechor, and he gets pishnayim. He gets a double share of the estate, he gets a double share of the Yerusha. The way we calculate that is, assuming there are four sons, we divide the estate into five sections. The Bechor gets two of those sections, two-fifths. The remaining three children each get one. At the end of the day, the Bechor has two-fifths, each of the other children gets one-fifth, the Bechor has pishnayim, he gets a double share. Now, as we mentioned before, grandchildren get nothing if the children are alive. If the children have predeceased the father, their children take their place. If a person does not leave over any children or any grandchildren, the Yerusha then goes up a level. It goes to his father. If his father is no longer alive, it goes to his father's Yerusha, which would mean his paternal brothers. Paternal brothers or paternal sisters, if they're not alive, it'll go to his nephews and nieces. Assuming even his father did not leave over any Yerushim, then we move the Yerusha up another level. It goes to the grandfather. The grandfather is probably no longer alive. It will go to his Yerushim, which means the deceased's cousins, etc., until we find, and this goes on and on, we move up and up a level until we find a Yerush, until we find someone who is related. Now, all Jews are related somehow. If you have to go up to Yaakov Avinu, that's what we'll do. And the Yerusha will rise a level and then fall down to those Yerushim until we find a relative, until we find someone who is a Yerush. Now, this is a synopsis of the Seder HaYerusha Midoraisa. In practice, things don't work out quite like this for a number of reasons. And I'd like to go through some of the basic issues that come up. The first point we mentioned is that a wife is not a Yerush. Al pi halacha, a wife does not receive any share of the inheritance. However, she does get a ksuba. Now, we're all familiar with a ksuba. When a person gets married, they sign a ksuba, that he obligates himself to pay a certain amount of money if they get divorced or if he dies. However, there's another part of the ksuba, the tnai ksuba, is that a woman is entitled to support until she remarries. If the husband dies before her, she's entitled to mezonos, she's entitled to support, she's entitled to live in the house, she's entitled to many medical expenses, and essentially she has a claim against the estate for her expenses. Whatever she needs to support the same standard of living that she enjoyed while her husband was alive. So what that means is that although when we deal with Hilchus Yerusha, when it's a question of who inherits the estate, who actually owns the assets, the Yerusha goes to the children. As a matter of practice, the wife will have a claim against the estate for all of her needs, for all of her support, until she remarries or claims the ksuba. I believe legally as well, in the very least, if he tries cutting his wife out of the will, in the very least, she'll have a claim for support, which works out well, it stems with the halacha. But again, what results is, although she's not a Yorish, she ends up with the best of both worlds. The assets themselves may belong to the children, they're the ones that will have to manage them, will have to care for it, the headache will be theirs, but she will have a claim of support until she remarries. But there's another very important factor when we're dealing with the rights of a spouse. Many people, when they buy houses, whose name is the house under? Very often it's jointly owned. It's put under both the husband and the wife's name. Now essentially what's happening is, when you do that, is you are making your wife a partner in the house. And therefore, the Hilchus Yerusha notwithstanding, Yerusha is a question of when a person passes away, who gets his estate? If, when you buy the house, you put it under her name, joint name, and it's understood that you're both partners in the house, she immediately, mechayim, is a shutif. She's a partner. And therefore, again, assuming it's clear that it was done with the intention of making her, of giving her rights to the house, in the very least, she will be entitled to half of the house, and possibly more. Many times when there is its own jointly, there are rights of survival, and therefore it's possible in halacha this right of survival will give her the right, not as far as Hilchus Yerusha, but as far as Kinyonim, she may very well likely be entitled to the house, irrespective of Hilchus Yerusha. Now this is true by a house. This is also true on a bank account. Most people have joint accounts. There are very often joint accounts with the spouse with the rights of survival, which means that whenever you're depositing money into the account, you're giving your spouse certain rights, certain schusim, to the money that you're depositing. Now, although, in a practical sense, I'm not convinced that whenever a person deposits money in the bank, he has das, he is now being makne, half of it, he's transferring half to his wife. In halacha, I don't think it'll make a difference. Because what is a bank account? A bank account is, you deposit money, you're lending money to the bank. In exchange for the money that you're lending to the bank has certain obligations to you. What are these obligations? So on a joint account, the obligation is, whenever you write a check, they're going to pay back the money that they borrowed from you. If you're no longer around, they're going to pay back to your spouse. So, putting aside Hilchus Kinyanim, ignoring Hilchus Yerusha, if we want to determine what the bank's obligations are, the bank's obligation is to pay the money back to the husband, if the husband's no longer around, to pay it back to the spouse. If that's the case, it doesn't really matter who the Yerushim of the husband may be. The bank never obligated themselves to return the money to the Yerushim. The understanding, the deal, when you set up the account and you set up the joint account in this way, the deal was the bank was going to pay back the husband or the spouse, whichever one survived the other one. And therefore, in such a case, I don't think we would look at Hilchus Kinyanim, I don't think we would look at Hilchus Yerusha. We would look at the bank's obligation, and therefore it's likely that the spouse would be entitled to any of the funds that are in a joint account, regardless of the fact that she may not be a Yerush. Now another common asset, which also seems to avoid the standard laws of Yerusha, is a life insurance policy. Again, we'll discuss term life, whole life may be a bit different. But in term life insurance, the life insurance company, in exchange for their premium, obligates to pay your beneficiaries. In that case, the value of this policy is not something which is subject to Yerusha. The person who took out the policy never owned this debt. The life insurance company never owed him the money. In exchange for the premiums, they said, we're going to pay your beneficiaries. That's not a debt that was owed to the person. It's not something which he can give away, or he would pass along the Yerusha. And therefore, if someone is named as a beneficiary on a life insurance policy, it would not matter whether they were a Yerush, they were not a Yerush, those assets would pass along to whoever the beneficiary was. So as a matter of practice, although going back, a wife may not be a Yerush, she will probably end up with a very large chunk of the estate simply through these various cheshbonos, the bank account, the house, and the life insurance policy. And on top of that, she'll have a claim for support. So that's the first point as far as a spouse is concerned. Let's move on to Bechor. As we all know, Bechor, the oldest child, is a son. He's entitled to Pishnayim. He's entitled to a double share of the estate. Now, first of all, this right of Pishnayim applies only to Yerusha Sa'av. When the father passes away, his Bechor gets a double share. However, when a mother passes away and the children are taking a share in the Yerusha, again, assuming the father is no longer alive or they're not married, in such a case, a Bechor does not get Pishnayim. It's only for the assets when they're inheriting the father, not when they're inheriting a mother. Now, the din of Pishnayim, this right that he has to a double share, has a very important exclusion. The Gemara darshins, b'chol asher yimotzei loy, the b'chor only gets this double share in assets that the father had in his possession. They were muhzik. He had them under his control at the time that he died. However, if it was roy, if the father had a gemach, he had lots of money which he lent out to people, since the monies are not muhzik, he's not holding on to it, they are loans, they were lent out to other people, that would not be subject to Pishnayim. All of the sons would inherit equally. Now, that leads us to a couple of very interesting questions. Person passes away. The Bechor says, Pishnayim, I get my double share. So clearly, a house, real estate, diamonds, jewelry, these are hard assets. The Bechor is entitled to his double share. What about money that was deposited in a bank? Now, if you think about it, as we mentioned before, what happens when you deposit money in a bank? You're essentially lending money to the bank. It's a debt that the bank has to you. Now, it may be a very secure debt, maybe not these days, but it doesn't matter. The din of roi, the din that a bechor gets pishnayim only on things that are tachas yadoi, applies to all debts. It's not a question of how secure or how light or how long it'll take you to collect it. And therefore, according to most poskim, money that's deposited in a bank has a din of roi, and a bechor would not get pishnayim. Now, this leads us to a fascinating distinction. And that is, as a matter of halacha, it'll probably depend which bank you deposited the money in. Why? If you deposit the money in Citibank, so you've lent the money to Citibank, it's roi, there's no din of pishnayim. Let's say, however, you deposited in IDB, a nice Jewish bank. Here the halacha is going to be different. Why? Because let's go back a step. You're putting the money in a Jewish bank. How in the world are you able to collect interest on a loan to a Jewish bank? What happened to the Yisur of Ribbis? So the answer is, again, this is the Igros Moshe, according to no personal liability, let's leave that aside for a moment. But the answer is that these Israeli banks have a hetereska. Now what does it mean that a bank has a hetereska? Hetereska, as the Igros Moshe explains, is not a kameya, it's not this magical document that you hang on the wall that says that there's no issa ribbis. A hetereska means that when you're giving money to a bank, it's not a loan, it's an investment, you're now a partner with a bank. And again, to make a complicated matter, just to simplify matters, essentially, half of the money that you give the bank is considered a loan, half of it is considered a pikadon, an investment. And the reason why you're entitled to interest, it's not interest, you're basically entitled to the return, to the profits that your investment generated. Now, if that's the case, that means half of the money that you give the bank, a Jewish bank with an iska, is not a loan, it's a pikadon, it's an investment. You're a partner in a bank. If two people are partners in a business, that's clearly mochzik. Clearly the bechara would get a double share of the business. The business may have, the headquarters may not be in your house, but that's called mochzik. It's your investment, you're a direct owner. The bechara gets a double share. So therefore many paskim say that if the father gives money be'iska and then dies, so on the Chelek Hanova, half of the Iska is Roy that the Bukhar doesn't get Pishnayim. But on the Chelek HaPikadoin, the half of it that's considered an investment, there many Poskim say the Bukhar will get Pishnayim, he'll get a double share of that half. Now again, it's not such a halacha psuka, because they choose to down a number of shitas, because of the nature of an Iska, it's not a regular investment. Therefore, some places can say that the entire thing, you get Pishnayim. Other places can take the other stream and say it's all considered Roy. But Roy of Paiskim seem to say that in an Isko is considered half a Pikadon, and that the Bechor gets Pishnayim. But this leads us to an even more interesting distinction. I would suggest that the rights of Bechor depend on whether he deposited the money in a branch in Eretz Yisrael or in New York. Why? Because let's think about this for a moment. Let's say I deposit the money in Eretz Yisrael in a Jewish bank. So what are we saying? We're saying now half of it is a loan, the Bechor has no rights to. The other half is a pikadon, it's an investment, and there's a concept of pishnayim. Okay, so half the money, I'm a partner with the bank. What business am I a partner with? What does the bank do with this money? The answer is, they lend it out to another person with an iska. If they're lending out the money, it's very nice, I'm a partner, but now I'm a partner with an iska. In iska, as we just described, half of it is a loan, half of it is a pikadon. So even on the chelek ha-pikadon, the part that I am a partner in, half of that is lent out, the bechor loses his rights. It's a loan. So in Eretz Yisrael, the bechor should be entitled to half of a half. The chelek ha-pikadon that he has, of that it gets cut in half when it gets loaned out to another yid, so he will get pishnayim on 25% of the deposit. Mashain Kane, if the deposit was in New York. In New York, I'm assuming most of their clients are not Jewish. If they're not Jewish, then they're taking the money, they're not giving it out as an iska. All of their money is lent out as a loan. If it's a loan, then the Bechor has absolutely no rights to Pishnayim. So therefore, again, if you deposit in a Goyish bank, you clearly would get, there would be no din of Bechor whatsoever. If it's in a Jewish bank that is re-lending the money to a non-Jew as a loan, there would also be no din of Bechor. If it's in a Jewish bank that's turning around and giving it over to another party within Iska, then he would be entitled to a Pishnayim on 25% of the deposit. Now this halacha is just a good illustration. Very often people will have a dispute and it'll go to Beis Din. And each party, when they go to Beis Din, is always convinced that they're completely right. They come in, they make their arguments, yelling and screaming. And then they get their verdict. And the psak seems to be a strange number. So people's reaction is usually, oh, the dayanim didn't understand the case, it's a pshara, they just guessed, they split the baby. This is a very good example about how halacha is very complicated. And depending on whether it's a Jewish bank or a not Jewish bank, or even in a Jewish bank, depending on whether this Jewish bank's clients are Jews or not Jews, New York, and they make very serious differences in halacha, tremendous nafkamina. And therefore, unless a person really knows halacha well and really understands what's happening, he shouldn't be so quick to jump to conclusions about a psak halacha, a psak din, or about dayanim. There's usually a lot more to it than what meets the eye. Stops. Oh, so the next question is stops. What happens if the father passes away and leaves over a portfolio? Now, technically speaking, what does it mean that I'm a shareholder? It means I'm a partner. If you own a couple of shares of Microsoft, you and Bill Gates are both partners. As a partner in a business that has hard assets, that should be considered muhzik, and the bechor should be entitled to his pishnayim, he should get his double share. But again, things are not so simple. The first question you're going to have to look at is, what are you a partner in? If you're a partner in a real estate company, you can make a pretty compelling argument that these are hard assets that are owned by the partnership. You get your pishnayim. If you're a partner in a bank, what assets does the bank have? So again, there may be some real estate here or there, but primarily the assets of the bank are going to be loans or financial assets. That itself would be ro'i, and therefore even if you're a partner, you still won't get a pishnayim because you're a partner in a loan, which again, is not subject to the din of pishnayim. Furthermore, there's a more basic question, and that is, as far as halacha is concerned, if you own a couple of shares of a company, are you really a partner? If you are a partner, you have a host of problems. Pesach, Shabbos, Ribbis, Yisurei Hana. I mean, again, most people own mutual funds, they go through their prospectus, if they happen to read it, their own shares in McDonald's and Burger King, and any Isser on the book, the company is probably involved in that. So many poiskim are makel, there's a Nigros Moshe Ebenezer, Simon Zion, that says that a person that owns a few shares of a public company is not considered a true partner. Again, legally perhaps he is, but as a matter of halacha, we do not look at every shareholder as a shutif, he's not a partner. Therefore, Rav Moshe is using it lahako, that he's not liable, he's not responsible for the isurim that may be done. It's not an issue if the company is open on Shabbos and engaging in ribbis and other isurim. But as far as Bukhar is concerned, if he's not really a partner, if a share just gives you the rights to dividends and certain cash flow in the future, that would again be considered roi, and there would not be a din of pishnayim. So again, in most cases, it'll depend on whether you follow the psak of Moshe. Even if you don't follow the psak of Moshe, you'll have to look at the financial statements, whether these are hard assets or these are financial assets. So this is basically the halachos of Bechor. Although, again, he gets pishnayim, there are very significant limitations as far as halacha l'maisa, and it will generally not end up with such a large extra share of the estate. Now, this is basically the Torah's Seder HaYerusha. Now, how many people in this room have written a will? Okay, you don't have time. Now, you don't have to answer the question, but how many of you, when you wrote the will, sat down, opened up a Shulchan Aruch, figured out al pi halacha what each child, grandchild, spouse is entitled to, and wrote in the will, made sure that it mirrored and reflected these halachas? Probably not too many of you. Why not? And the reason why not is that most people look at the Seder HaYerusha as a default. A person dies. He has an estate. You can't take it with you. So we have to figure out what to do with the estate. How do we divide it? So on that we have a Seder HaYerusha. The Torah tells us if there's no will, there's no tzava, we don't know what to do, this is how to divide it. And I think that's the way most people understand the concept of Nachlos, the concept of Yerusha. Let's learn a Mishnah. Mishnah Bava Vassar and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Beis. Hakosiv Nuchosiv La'acherim. Someone who writes his assets to others. He gets into a fight with his children. They don't call him enough. They don't visit enough. He cuts him out of the will. Masha Asu Yasu. The first point the Mishnah makes is Masha Asay Asay. It's done. A person has the ability to write a will. A person has the ability to modify and to decide who gets his estate. And it's effective. Again, there are guidelines that you have to follow. We'll get to that later. But assuming it's done with the appropriate kinyanim, you do it, you do it. However, Chazal are not happy with what you did. A person should not be disinheriting the Yerushim al pi halacha. Now, in Rucham Neichi Menu, the Ranach says, it doesn't just mean that Chazal aren't happy, it means there's an Isser. It's Isser for a person to cut out his Yerushim al pi halacha. The Mishnah continues, the Rav Shim Gamliel Loimer, Rav Shim Gamliel says that there's one case where it's Motzer, one case you're allowed to do this. Im loy hayu barav noyin kishura, his children were not acting appropriately. Now again, it doesn't mean they didn't call you ever before Shabbos, or they didn't come to you for Pesach. It means that the children were Rishayim. In that case, Rav Shim Gamliel Paskin, Zohar Lutoiv. There's nothing wrong with cutting him out of the will, and fakir, it's appropriate. If he's a Rasha, he's going to use the assets to continue doing Averis, continue doing Yisurim. He should be cut out of the will. So the Gemara says, do we pass in like Rav Shimon Gamliel or not? So the Gemara goes back and forth, and finally the Gemara of Basra says, I'm Rav Shmuel, Rav Yehuda. Shmuel paskins, a person should not be there, he should not witness when someone is writing a will that's going to be avuri achsanta, is going to cut out the yoyrish al pi halacha. The afil mi brabish lebratav. Even if you're trying to cut out a child that's a rasha and give the money instead to a child who's a tzaddik, still it's also to do, and you shouldn't be involved. Now from Shmuel we learn two halachas. First of all, Shmuel is clearly paskinig, not like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Even if a child is a rasha, still, you should not cut him out of the will, you should not deprive him of his inheritance. We don't give up on Jewish children so fast. The second halacha that Shmuel tells us is that the isser of avuri achsanta, the isser of playing around with the Yerusha, doesn't just apply to the testator. Shmuel told Yehuda to have a avuri achsanta. Don't go there. Don't be there. Shmuel was saying that a person should not witness, a person should not assist someone who is trying to cut out a yorish al pi halacha. Now this din can cause serious problems. If you're an estate planner, if you're an attorney, a client comes in and wants to cut out a child, according to Shmuel saying, you cannot be involved in the process, you can't help them out. Now, it is important to realize that Shmuel is not saying a question of Isser v'hetar. Shmuel doesn't say you're being over an Isser by being involved. The Poskim understand Shmuel to be a Midas Chassidus. Because a person, Avuri Achsanta is Osir, it's Ein Ruach HaMnoichi Menu. As a Midas Chassidus, you should not help, you should not assist, you shouldn't be involved. However, if a person is in a situation where this is his Parnasa, and he cannot get out of it, then a person for a Midas Chassidus would not be Mechuyev to give up his Parnasa to endanger his livelihood, and therefore it's certainly Mokin for a person to be Mekel. Clearly, if you're in a position to talk the person out of it, to convince him that this is alpi halacha, this is not appropriate, and that the child should not be cut out, clearly that is the right thing to do. But if that's impossible, and it's a question of do you have to refuse to do it and put your parnasa on the line, because it is not a question of isser v'hetzer, it is a midas chassidus, a person would have the right to be mekel. Now, going back to Shmuel. Shmuel and the Mishnah is clearly telling us that there's an isser of avuri achsanta. When the Torah says who the Yerushim are, who Yarshins, the Seder HaYerusha, it's not just the default. This is what the Torah wants. In fact, what would you say to the following situation? The woman was on her deathbed. She calls someone over. She hands him a bag full of diamonds, full of money. And says, I want you to take this money. And after I die, do with it the best thing that can be done with this money. That's it. With those words, she dies. What do you do with these diamonds? No, you don't pocket them. No. So, I think what the first thing that would come to people's mind is they would find a yeshiva, open a kollel, a shul, a beis medrash, kupas ezra, temche shabbos. Everyone has all sorts of ideas of what should be done with this money. That's not what the Mordechai writes. The Mordechai paskins, and this is quoted by the Ramah, is, you know what to do with the money? Open up a shulchan aruch, find out who the yerushim are, and give it to the yerushim. Now, I think the Mordechai doesn't say makar for it, but it's clearly based on this Mishnah, because of the Isra of Abu Rech Santa. I think it's a very compelling argument. If the best thing to do, to happen to a person's estate, was that when he dies, it goes to charity, that would have been the halacha. Then when a person dies, we have an estate tax, Uncle Sam takes half of it, the Torah would have said, when you die, we confiscate it, it goes to Hebrish, it goes to Tzedakah. It doesn't say that in the Torah. Obviously, the halacha, and the best thing to do with this, is to distribute it to the Yerushim. And therefore, as a matter of halacha, the Mordechai, the Ramah both say, it doesn't go to Tzedakah, it goes to the Yerushim. Now let's go back to the Feinberg clause. What was Max Feinberg doing with this Jewish clause? Essentially what he was writing was that if a child intermarries, if he's a Russia, he gets cut out of a will. Now it seems this is Keneged a Mefurash HaMishnah. We've just learned there's an Isser of Avur Eich Santa. Even if the child is a Russia, he should not be cut out of the will. And this is the Mishnah that the attorney was learning. And they realized, we can't file this brief. We can't be fighting to uphold a clause which seems to violate halacha. Now again, this comes to show askanus is not such an easy thing. You know, although when you hear the story, you hear the clause, the judge, assimilation, it sounds terrible. We have to follow halacha. Now, as a matter of halacha, things are not so simple. There's Maram Sheik and Choshen Mishpat Simon Nem Gimel, and a similar concept in the Ibris Moshe, in Cherek Beis, Simon Nun. And they write as follows. What is the pshat in this halacha? Why are you not allowed to cut out a child that's a Russian? So the Gemara in Ksubis adds a couple of words. We don't know what the children will be like. This child may be a Russia. You may have completely given up hope on this child. There's always hope for the Enochluch. There's always hope for the grandchildren. And therefore, he's your child. Don't cut him out of the will. Zakim Ram Shek. That's only true if the son is raising his children as Jews. What happens if the child is a mumer lahachis? What happens if he's a mechal shabbos b'farhesia? So in those cases where he's no longer living, he's no longer raising his children as Jews, statistically, there's not that much hope for the grandchildren. Again, you never know. People can be chozer b'tshuva, but al pi pashtus, it's not going to happen. And therefore, the Igros Moshe paskins that when a child is a mechal shabbos b'farhesia, this Isser does not apply, and here everyone would read through Shimon Gamliel, you would have the right to cut them out of the Yerusha. If this is true by a Mechal Shabbos, it's true by a Mummer, clearly it's true by a grandchild that marries out. Once the spouse is not Jewish, so again, if you're dealing with a grandson marrying a non-Jewish woman, then the children are not going to be Jewish at all. Even in the other case, because they're not being brought up with a Jewish identity, here everyone would agree to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, and the Isser of Avur Eich Santa would not apply. Ultimately, when this was brought to the organization's attention, they went ahead, they did file the brief, and I am happy to report that it actually was appealed twice. It made it to the Illinois Supreme Court. Ultimately, the ruling was overturned, mostly on technical grounds, but at the end of the day, this Jewish clause was upheld. It was just finished recently. I mean, this litigation was going on for years, if not decades. Now, this helps us in a very extreme case. If Nebo, if a person's grandchildren are assimilated in Mechalei Shabbos, the Isra of Uri Santa would not apply. What about a typical case? Most people that write wills, as we established before, do not necessarily follow the Seder HaYerusha to the T. What happens to the Isra of Ruach Santa? Are there any heterim, and under what circumstances does a person have a right to modify and to play around with his will in the way that he sees fit? Daughters also, exactly. Daughters, spouse, these are all cases. So the Ktzoyis brings down a Tashbeitz, who's actually quoting a Sefer Yitzer, that says as follows. The Minhag, the Yitzer writes that in the wills that they used to write, they used to leave over four zuz for their halachic yorshim. In other words, they would write a will, they would give it to whoever they chose, their spouse, their daughters, whoever they wanted to give the money to. They would leave over four zuz that should be distributed to the halachic yorshim al pi the seder ha-yerusha. In that case, the Tashbeitz writes, there's no isra of Ruach Santa. In other words, they learn that it's a koisiv kol nechosav la'acherim. The isser is to completely disinherit a yerush. However, if it's not complete, if it's just partial, then the iter holds, the isser of Ruach Santa does not apply. So now the question is, what does it mean to leave over four zuz? Does anybody know how much four zuz is today? So here the place can tell us, you don't have to go ahead and figure out how much gold there was and what the price of gold was some 1,200 years ago. The place can write that four zuz means, at that time, it was a meaningful amount. It was a meaningful amount. If a person leaves a meaningful amount of the estate to his halachic yorshim, according to the Yitzer, he's free to distribute the rest as he sees fit. Now, what is a meaningful amount? There are no hard rules. The Igros Moshe, in one tshuva, he writes, a fifth of the estate would be a meaningful amount. Now obviously, if you have six sons, and you leave each a fifth of the estate, you're going to have a problem. So obviously, it depends on how many children there are, the size of the estate. In another tshuva, the shoyel, the person asking the question, described a will where he left each son $1,000. The Igros Moshe writes back, according to the Yitzer, that would be fine. But again, it's hard to know. You have to know the size of the estate, what $1,000 was back then. It's hard to give a clear guideline. But I'll call upon it, if you're leaving a meaningful amount, according to the Yitzer, as long as the halachic yorshim have a meaningful amount, you're free to do what you want with the rest. Now this is a very important halacha. When a person, many people, especially if you're dealing with a more modest estate, leave all of their nechasim and all of their assets to their wife, that is a classic case of Avurech Santa. And the only way it would be mutter, again, we'll discuss it at length a little bit later, but the only way it would be mutter, even according to this ether, would be, is if you leave over Dal Zuz, you leave over a meaningful amount for the sons, for the Yorshim of Pihalacha to get it. And in that case, according to Tashbeitz, you can be maker. Now this Tashbeitz is not Lekuleyama, it's not accepted by everyone. Other poiskim, Chassam Sofer, based on Rashbam, and there's Meiri as well, say nothing to him. They say, Ein l'chanami, you're right. They're completely disinheriting a child is certainly worse than a partial. Chassam Sofer writes, if you completely disinherit a child, there's a klalo brought down in the Yerushalmi. If it's only a partial, if you're leaving over the halachic yorshim with something, you don't get a klalo, but it's still Ein rach chacham noichimen. And therefore, the Chassam Sofer writes, there is no heter to tinker with the Seder HaYerusha at all. Other places can take somewhat of a middle ground, the Sechuvah and Simon Reish Peveis, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and the Shevet HaLevi also says a similar pshat. They say, it depends. It depends why you're doing it. If you want to disinherit a child completely, that's always going to be awesome. If you want to partially disinherit him, leave the halachic yorshim something, a meaningful amount, but give the rest. So it depends what you're doing with the rest of the money. Because the Tshuva says, if you want to give it to tzedakah, that's fine. That's a hetzer. As long as you leave something to the yorshim, that would be okay. But just on a whim to decide that, hey, this child wasn't polite to me, didn't give me enough respect, I want to take away part of the Yerusha and give it to someone else. In that case, even according to Tashbeitz, the Pesach Shuvah and the Shulchan Rav Paskin, it would be awesome. Shimon HaLevi adds a little bit. Shimon HaLevi writes that when you're cutting out a child completely, that's aser, and again, unless you're dealing with a mumer, that's never justified. However, when you're not cutting out someone completely, you're just modifying it somewhat. There he says, it's a midas chasidus not to do so. A midas chasidus. It's not an iser, and not a midas chasidus. Therefore, if it's a mitzvah, if you want to give part of the money to tzedakah, or even a dvar mitzvah, it doesn't have to be a true mitzvah. Again, we're dealing with midas chasidus. If it's a midas chasidus, we have the right to make cheshbonos. It's a midas chasidus to leave the Yerusha the way it is. But there's another, on the other hand, there's another compelling reason, a dvar mitzvah, to modify it. Then the Shevet HaLevi says, there's malkum to be made. Yeah, Rabbi Yochanan Breka is discussing as far as mechanically when it does work, when it doesn't work. Lashon Yerusha, Lashon Matana, giving it to another Yerush, giving it to an outside party. We're discussing a question of Isser V'Heter, whether it's appropriate to play with it. And it's the entire concept of Shemira clearly shows that a person has the ability to change. We're discussing whether it's the right thing to do. The Isser Avurech Santa Pashas would apply as well. And there is an Isser of Yuchel Avakir if you use a Lashon Yerusha. It could be it's more chomer in some cases. So where does that leave us as far as Halacha L'Maaseh? So as far as Halacha L'Maaseh, if you look through the Achronim, very few Achronim are Soymech on the Tashbeitz alone. Very few Achronim say, as long as you leave a Davar Mu'at, do whatever you want. However, whenever there's a Dvar Mitzvah, or whenever there is a compelling reason to make a modification, then, B'tziruf, the Tashbeitz, they're making. So for example, a person wants to leave money to his spouse. As we discussed earlier, although a wife is not a Yerush, does not receive any Yerusha min HaTorah, Chazal were clearly concerned with her welfare and gave her very significant claims for support, for mezainis, for certain medical bills, for living in the house, etc. If a person is concerned that things won't work out that simply, going to Beis Din is not a simple matter. He's afraid that his children will not give his wife the proper respect. And therefore, he wants to add something in the will to make it easier, to make sure that she's cared for. So here, clearly, there's an inyan of a Dvar Mitzvah. He is addressing a concern that Chazal were concerned about. And therefore, if a person wants to do that, it's a place to all say it's certainly mutter and appropriate to do it. Again, you can't get carried away. You still have to leave a dalat zuzah, and you still have to leave a meaningful amount to the yersha. But if you add giving to your wife to make sure that she's cared for and will not have problems getting support, that would be mutter. Daughters are a bit more interesting. Although we mentioned earlier a daughter is not a yersh, there is a minhag in Klal Yisrael for hundreds of years, it's brought down by the Ramah, to give the daughters a share of the yerusha. The classic Yerusha was a shtar chatzi zachar. A daughter would receive half of the share of a son. Whereas a bechor would get double, a regular son would get one share, a daughter would get half of that. Now this custom has been around for a very long time. It's the Nachla Shiva, the Ramah. So the place we're bothered by, what is the justification to do this? What happened to the Isser of Avurei Zanta? So there are various terutim. Obviously, if you go with the Tashbeitz, if you hold a partial redistribution as mutter, that explains this minhag. They only gave the daughter a half a share. They left over a meaningful amount to the halachic yersha. And therefore, according to the Tashbeitz, the minhag is very simple to understand. What about the shittas that argue on the Tashbeitz? So here, Maharam Mintz writes, and this is the reason that most Achroinim go with, that it's true. There's an Isra of Avurei Santa. The person shouldn't play around with the Seder HaYerusha. On the other hand, there's also a mitzvah on a father, an obligation to help marry off his daughters. And therefore, they write that this is part of the Nedunya. When a daughter got married, the custom was to give a dowry, they gave a certain amount of money to the son-in-law. People didn't necessarily have the cash to plunk down a dowry big enough. So instead, they gave them a shtar chatzi zofer. that the Shver would tell the son-in-law, that Achameir Be'esrim, you're going to get a share of the Yerusha, you're going to get a share of the estate, and that was either in the place or as to bolster the Nedunya. The Yerushim Maramins explains, although normally you're not supposed to tinker with the Yerusha, because it's only a partial redistribution, and there's a Devar Mitzvah, you're doing this in order to marry off your daughters, that's why it became mutter. That's how the custom evolved, and there would be nothing wrong with doing it. Good point. So the place today, no one writes Ishtar. They used to write Ishtar Chatzi Zohar at the Chasim. It was at the same time they gave a diary, they would write it. So some place can point out that today, if you don't write it at the Chasana, it's too late. And once they're married, if you're doing your estate planning 30 years later, there should be no heter to give the daughter anything. However, Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg has a tshuva where he basically says that the reason why no one asks for a Shtar Chatzi Zohar when they get married is that it's understood that they will be included in the will. They will not be cut out of the estate, and that's why they don't ask for it. It's just understood. And therefore he says, even if you do your estate planning, this heter would apply. So now clearly if a person wants to give his daughters a half a share, there's clearly no problem. He's following a custom which, while it's not current, it was certainly around for a very long time. There's precedent. He clearly has the right to do that. The question is, what happens if a person is not happy with a chatzi zachar? He wants to treat his daughters the same as his sons. He wants to give them an equal share. Now, this leads us to a bit of an interesting point. Technically, as a matter of halacha, there's really no difference between giving a daughter a half a share or a whole share. In both cases, you're modifying the Seder HaYerusha. In both cases, you're leaving the sons with a significant share of the estate. And therefore, there's no real halachic difference. Again, there's some sefer that does actually make a difference out of it, but the standard reasons that are discussed in the Poskim, there should be no difference between the two. Nevertheless, the Chasam Sofer and the Chazon Ish has a letter, which is very strongly written, where they write, both cases they were responding to someone who wanted to give the daughter an equal share. Chasam Sofer says, I see that's what you want to do. Loi tihi chelki imah. If you're into equality, you want to make things fair, you don't understand the hashkafa of the Torah, and that's why you're trying to change things, leave me out of it, I don't want to be involved, I don't want to help you draft the will. Chazanish adds that this movement to that a daughter should yarshin the same as a son, this was a fight that has the Chacham had with the Tzedukim. It represents a trefa hashkafa, and therefore Chazanish also takes very strong issue with this philosophy or this outlook. Now, that being said, very often on a practical level, a person leaves a daughter with a half a share. What's going to happen next is World War III. The daughters will not be so understanding, if the daughter is the son-in-law, certainly won't be very understanding. It can cause tremendous machloikis, it can cause tremendous issues. If that's the case, and you're motivated to avoid machloikis, you're motivated because the daughter needs the money, you're motivated for a legitimate purpose, then as a matter of halacha, you certainly have what to be soimach on, you have the tashbeitz, and there's certainly room in Mokoyim to be Mekel and to give the daughter a complete share. However, you need to think about it. If your motivation is, from a philosophical point of view, you believe in equality, then there's a serious problem with this behavior. I need to really think twice before you go ahead and do that. Now, again, there are a number of other halachos of Reich Santa. We're not going to have a chance to address them all. I'd just like to make two or three general points about Yerusha. The first is that I cannot stress enough how important it is to write a will. Why? It's described the Seder HaYerusha. When a person dies al pi halacha, this Seder HaYerusha defines who gets the assets. If a person dies without a will, what's going to happen? The estate goes into probate, and it gets divided, depending on what state you live in, under certain rules. Administration. Whatever those rules are, or however this estate is going to be divided. I can tell you one thing. It's not going to be divided al pi halacha. And that'll lead to a tremendous problem. You'll have certain people who will have legal rights to the estate that will get the distributions. Al pi halacha, it's not theirs. Al pi halacha, if they keep it, if they use it, they're very likely stealing. And therefore, if a person dies without a will, he's essentially, in a set, almost forcing his loved ones, his wife, his daughters, whatever it may be, to be ganovim. Be over, probably yisurim d'oraisa, and hold on to money that isn't theirs. And therefore, it's extremely important that a person write a will. Now, when a person does write a will, there are serious questions as to whether a civil will is meaningful in halakha. In general, again, it's a complex matter, I'm just going to generalize. In general, when a person wants to transfer his assets, he has to make a kinyan, he needs a certain act to make the transfer, and the transfer has to be done mechayim. It generally has to be done while he's still alive. A will is a document that transfers the nechasim after he dies. And therefore, there are serious questions in halakha whether a will has meaning and is binding on the yorshim. Nevertheless, there are shitas that say it is binding. There's an igros moisha that says there will a will because it's enforceable in dinah malchus medinah. There's gemiras das and the igros moisha says it is a kinyan. Other places can be achiezer says although it's not a real kinyan, there's a mitzvah kaim debrei hames. There's an enforceable obligation to honor the testator's instructions, even if it wasn't carried out properly. Even those that argue on the Achiezer, very often there's a mitzvah of kibbutz. If the father made certain instructions, this is how I want the estate distributed, even if the contract, you know, the will was not executed al pi halacha, there will likely either be a mitzvah of kibbutz or at least an inyan of kibbutz to listen. So therefore, if a person has a will, the yorshim, if they do go, if the beneficiaries, if they take possession of it, they certainly have a lot to be sunuch on that it won't be gezel, that they're very likely entitled to these assets. However, if he dies in this state without a will whatsoever, it's going to be a tremendous problem. Now, when a person does write a will, again, we're basically out of time, but there is a concept, there is an addendum that people add to wills to make it halakhically enforceable. In a nutshell, what the addendum essentially does is like this. A person writes a will, he distributes the estate however he wants, based on the halachas we discussed today. He gets a lawyer to draft a will that will be enforceable in court. And then he does as follows. He figures out who are the legal beneficiaries of this will who are going to get more assets than they're entitled to al pi halacha. Now this could be a spouse, could be a daughter, whichever beneficiaries are getting more based on the will than al pi halacha. The person then goes ahead and creates a debt. He writes a document, I owe each of these people $3 million. Whatever the number is. However, this debt is conditional. If my halakhic yorshim honor my instructions, they honor the provisions of the will, of the trust, and they give this, they divide the estate as per my instructions, this debt is null and void. So what happens is a very interesting situation. The person dies. Legally, who gets the nechasim? The estate goes whatever based on whatever the will says, whatever the trust says. Al pi halacha, the will may not be binding, and it may belong to the sons, it may belong to the halachic yorshim. However, if the sons want to exercise those rights, the sons want to claim the estate, the daughters or the wife or whoever the legal beneficiaries come with this document that says the father had a debt of $3 million. They're here to collect the debt. The sons now have two choices. Either they say, okay, you know what? The estate is worth $2 million. The debt is $3 million. So you know what? You take the share of the estate that it says in the will. And let's forget about the debt. It's null and void. That's usually what will happen. So by creating this addendum, again, there's more to it, but by creating this addendum, it's a way, it's not a kinyan, you're not rewriting the will, you're not redoing what the lawyer or your estate planner is doing, you're essentially creating a document that will force the yorshim, force the halachic inheritors to respect the wishes and voluntarily, if you will, voluntarily honor what you've done and give the nechassim to whoever you instructed them to give it to. Thank you very much.